Hi, everybody, and welcome to Martin Bandyke Undercovers for November 2021, produced in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. Our interview this month is with author Anna Araújo about her book, No Compromise, the work of Florence Knoll. Florence Knoll was a leading, essential force of modern design. She worked from 1945 to 1965 at Knoll Associates, first as business partner with her husband, Hans Knoll, later as president after his passing, and then finally as design director. Her commissions became hallmarks of the modern era, including the Barcelona chair by Mies van der Rohe, the diamond chair by Harry Bertoia, and the Plattner collection by Warren Plattner. She created classics like the Parallel Bar collection, which is still in production today. No Compromise looks at Knoll's extraordinary career in close-up from her student days in Michigan at the acclaimed Cranbrook Academy of Art to her professional accomplishments. I began my interview with Anna Araújo by asking about her career and ultimately what led her to writing this new book about Florence Knoll.
Well, I'm an architect. And I teach at the Architectural Association, at the AA. I've taught in many schools. I'm originally from Brazil. I taught in many schools in Brazil and then in the UK. I did my PhD in the UK a long time ago and started being interested in the work of women designers and their contribution. And I started studying the theory, you know, feminist theory in design and in the arts, and I did an exhibition on a Brazilian architect named Lina Bobardi some years ago. I have been writing and publishing on the topic, and then decided I wanted to write a book about one important modernist woman designer, and studied a number of them, and then decided to work with Florence Knoll.
And take us into the world and the life of Florence Knoll. Fascinating. There's all sorts of Michigan connections here with Florence, starting with the fact that she was born in the state of Michigan. Where was she born?
Saginaw?
Yeah, yes. It's in like the thumb area of Michigan, like about there, you know, literally.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. And she grew up and went to school in Michigan as well. Take us into her early years.
Yeah, well, the issue with her is that she became an orphan very early on. Her father died first, and then her mother died, and she had lost her brother already when she was a child. And she was taken on by a guardian who, curiously enough, wasn't a member of her family. And he took her to a number of boarding schools to see where she would like to, you know, to do her studies. And then she chose to go to Cranbrook. She said it was like love at first sight. Because the school obviously had been designed by very important architects, and it must have appealed to her sensibility.
Have you had a chance to visit Cranbrook yourself?
Yes.
It's really special, isn't it?
It's a wonderful place. Yeah, it's very nice, and it's very important to the history of architecture. You know, obviously because the Saarinens, who you know, originally Scandinavian, came to the U.S. and settled there, and they met this visionary entrepreneur called George Booth and his wife, and they were starting the Cranbrook project, and they had many ideas in common relating a bit to the arts and crafts movement in England. And then, so it was, you know, it was a very important context in modern design. And I think Knoll was lucky to be where she was and to have come across this opportunity so early in her life. So she started, you know, her trajectory in design aged 12, you know.
Wow. Mm. Wow. What she wanted to do at a super young age. Yeah. And you mentioned the Saarinen. She was very close to them, wasn't she? This is fascinating.
And then obviously, you know, being an orphan, she stood out. You know, very likely she stood out in the context of the Kingswood School for Girls, which is part of the Cranbrook Art Academy. And also she was the only girl in her class who decided very early on that she wanted to study architecture. So that meant that Elio Saarinen, the famous architect, took her on and started to be her mentor, you know.
What a person to have as a mentor. Are you kidding me?
Yes, when you're still a teenager.
When did she study? What time frame are we talking about? And when did she graduate from Cranbrook? About when are we talking about?
So she started in Cranbrook in the early 30s. So she was one of the first. She was a student of the second cohort of the Kingswood School for Girls. So right when the school was launched. And she graduated in 1935. And then she started a journey around the world to complete her architectural studies. You know, she went to study town planning under Le Corbusier. And then she went to London to the Architectural Association, where I currently teach, actually. And then she went back to Chicago to study under Mies van der Rohe.
My goodness. All of these top names that you're mentioning. And then when did her career really begin as a designer? What were some of the early things that she did that just made her, you know, a mark in this area of design? And where was she living at that time?
Yeah, well, she established this relationship with Cranbrook that she kind of went back and forth. So she had this first, you know, this first experience at the Kingswood School still as a teenager. And then she went around, but she had interruptions in her studies, like, you know, years where she interrupted her formal education, and she came back to Cranbrook to do a year, because the education in Cranbrook was very informal, and it allowed for this type of you know, for people to do this. So I think it was the second time that she came to Cranbrook that she became even closer to Eero Saarinen. And I say in the book that when she designed her dormitory in Cranbrook under the encouragement of Eero, it's actually the first iteration of the no look. It's the first iteration of the famous interior that she would mature in the later stages of her career, because this dormitory had all the elements that the no interior, the future no interior, because she wasn't a no back then. She was a schust, right? Because she hadn't married Hans No yet. So that was like the first iteration. But in the book, I even talk about her very early projects, two houses that she designed still in her first experience at the Cranbrook Art Academy, where you can see, as it were, she's just kind of warming up to the language that she would later develop.
Mm. Talk more about her relationship and with Hans Noll. Yeah, how did Florence Schust meet Hans Noll, and when did that all happen?
Yeah, so this was later. Then she was already an architect, and she went to New York, and she started freelancing for various architectural offices. Now, you know, we have to remember that the profession of interiors wasn't as well established as it is today. It was partly Florence Noll who helped establish it in the way we know today. At the time, you had like what we what they called at the time interior decorators, but the profession of interiors wasn't that established. So she was freelancing here and there with collaborating with architects, mostly to design the interiors. You know, being a woman, people assumed that she would you know, be good at it. So she was freelancing for a number of offices, and in one of them she met Hans, and Hans was establishing his furniture company, and he wanted someone to help with the interiors, basically creating a proper atmosphere and ambiance for the furniture, the modern furniture he was launching, and they started to collaborate. So this, now we are already in the early 1940s. But they actually became official partners in 1946. And that related to an event in the professional trajectory of Hans Noll, where, he made a commercial transaction and he ran out of cash. Oh. Yes. And, Florence Noll had to invest her own money, obviously being an orphan of a very well-off family. She had the trust fund and she had to invest her own money to help out Hans to continue his adventurous trajectory in the field, you know, his enterprise of launching modern design in America. And in this event, they became business partners and also they got married soon after that. So that is 1946.
1946. Okay. All right. And how long were they married? Tell us a little bit more about the relationship before we're going to talk about the Noll look. But what was their marriage like, and how long were they married?
Yeah. So they got married in 1946, and Hans died tragically in 1955. He had a car accident in Cuba, in Havana, when they were doing the American embassy in Cuba, and he was on a business trip and he had this car accident. So it was a fairly short relation, like it was cut short, yeah, by this tragic death, when the company was at its peak, really. So it was a, you know, relatively short collaboration, but a very fruitful one.
So we're talking about just this, the modern design as we know it with the Noll look. What are some of the top pieces that Florence had a hand in designing that we still know today from her work? These are really iconic pieces that she designed and helped design. What are some of these?
Yeah, well, the important thing to say is that Noll was very discreet. I mean, she had a very discreet personality and she was very unassuming about her furniture designs. So she said her furniture designs were like meat and potatoes, like basic pieces that were there to complement the kind of wow pieces, the sparkling pieces designed by her colleagues, most of which she had met in Cranbrook. You know, one of the biggest Noll collaborators was obviously Eero Saarinen. You know, so we're talking with regards to furniture she commissioned. We're talking about the Womb collection by Eero Saarinen. We're talking about the Tulip collection by Eero Saarinen. We're talking about the collaboration with Harry Bertoia, you know, another series of classics. We're talking about her representation of Mies van der Rohe furniture, which already existed previous to Noll, but which was produced in a very on and off basis. Like when Mies found the right people, manufacturers to produce, he would do this, he would produce the furniture mainly for specific projects. And it was Florence Noll who actually took this furniture into mass production. Now, with that said, she was, it's something that I talk in a book, in the book, she was an amazing furniture designer. She was just, modest about it. So for instance, her parallel bar collection, is today very famous and, very popular. It was designed to be more, less flashy, so to speak, than the, what she called the sculptural pieces that were all of them actually produced by male architects. So she was there like as a, you know, not as the protagonist, but as, you know, in a kind of supporting role. But in the end of the day, when we investigate her work, we actually find out that hadn't she been there, not much would have happened. Or, you know, I think it's fair to say that nothing would have happened.
What was the no look? Were these pieces instant hits? Was we take these all for granted now? These are so iconic and so classic, and they look so great still here in 2021. But was this look a kind of shocking or a little avant-garde for average people or people who bought furniture for offices? Do they have to really kind of do a hard sell to get people to purchase these items?
Yes, I think they did. They had some strategies. I think Hans was a very charming person, a very smart businessman. So he worked very hard, and with having Florence Knoll to support him with her, you know, having had an excellent education and being a very competent designer, they managed to make a name for themselves. But yes, it was certainly hard. There were at the time a number of fairs, like you have furniture fairs and textile fairs and trade fairs in which they participated. And very early on, Florence Knoll came up with the notion of the showroom, which was to present her furniture in settings like office settings or domestic settings. Now, this didn't exist at the time. People were used to seeing furniture in a kind of warehouse kind of model, like just lined up furniture in a big open space. And she started to create these settings. And this helped a great deal for people to visualize what the spaces could look like and how, you know, charming and functional they could be. So this was one of the strategies. Now, another strategy was like liaising with the right people. So Knoll became very well connected as soon as he arrived in New York. And, one of the first projects that they did was for the Rockefellers, you know, and Florence Knoll jokes that whenever a client was doubtful about the approach and wanted to go more traditional, they said, well, that's not what the Rockefellers are doing. and the client would immediately, you know, change their minds. And another strategy was obviously collaborating with architects which already had a name.
Ah, I see.
Right. So because Florence Knoll had, you know, all these connections from Cranbrook, even from the Architectural Association, from the school in Chicago where she studied under Mies, she had a number of contacts, and she relied. So, you know, for instance, they worked very early on as well with SOM, which is still a very important office for corporate architecture.
So, go ahead. Complete your thought.
Yeah. Please. So that was, you know, so I guess like their strategies were partly like the invention of the showroom, the collaboration with important clients, which they met through the important contacts, and the collaboration with architects, which they, they happen to know mainly because of Florence Knoll.
I want to hear more about their motto, no compromise ever. And was that something they were able to adhere to, that Florence Knoll was able to adhere to? It must have been really difficult, especially in that time frame, to be a woman in her field. And you use this no compromise as part of the title of your book. This is really important what you talk about here in the book.
Yeah, I think as a company, I would say that, yes, they managed to compromise very little and to put their design ideas forward, which was really extraordinary considering they were, I think it's safe to say, they were the first. So they had a very firm position. But obviously, this was all backed up by studies, like, you know, Florence Knoll would when she would do an office, a big office, she would interview all sorts of employees to make sure that the desk she was designing was right for this secretary, that the office she was designing for the executive director met their needs. And so, you know, there is a lot of the look, which is obviously very appealing, but there is a lot of efficiency behind it as well. And in a very large project that they did for an insurance company, they had to prove that they managed to save space in order to get the job, you know. So she was working very hard, and because the look was so clean and the light was so well designed, they managed to reduce, like, the offices are actually, you know, very small. The not the main office of the executive director, but the executive offices are very small, and obviously by doing the open plan, they also save space. So it wasn't only the argument of how beautiful modern design is. It was also an argument of efficiency and saving money and et cetera, you know. I would say, yeah, as a company, they achieved a great deal and they managed to compromise very little. I think as a designer and as a woman designer, I would say that Florence Knoll did have to compromise. I mean, first she had to play this supportive role, because I'm not sure if she had taken the approach of designing this sculptural flashy furniture, if that would go down well with the image that women had at the time, that they needed to be more subdued, a little bit submissive, etc. So yes, she was a very firm professional, but I think, like, as a designer, she calibrated her role very well, not to be rejected, so to speak, not to be, you know. So I think she had a, you know, she played a careful game there. It wasn't like she was just doing what she wanted.
Mm-hmm. And final question, Anna. Florence Knoll lived to be, my goodness, 101.
Yeah.
She lived until early 2019. How long in that time frame did her career last? Did she work late into her life?
Well, no, that's the sad part that I talk about in the book as well. She retired in the mid-60s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So early.
Yeah. This is one of the things that I discuss in the book as well. Like, she remarried, and she remarried a banker and he lived in Florida. And she, one of the things that she says, it was becoming very hard to commute, you know, and to be able to work as hard as she had to work at Knoll in order, you know, and that it's at the same time to be at home. But also she says, in some moments that she got a bit tired of the kind of repetitiveness of the work. And this is where I say that perhaps she fell prey to her own success, because she became so well known for the kind of corporate look that she invented, that people wanted more and more of her, you know, to do this. And I think she felt perhaps that, you know, she didn't want to do it for another 20 years or for another 30 years. So I dedicate a chapter, the final chapter in the book, to her private commissions after she retired, where she develops a look that is different from the no look, that obviously draws from it, but which is a little bit, I say, less orthodox, a little bit more playful, perhaps, than what she was, you know, developing before. And I think we are lucky to see these two facets of her as a designer, but I personally would have liked to see many more.
Thanks for listening to Martin Van Dyke Undercovers for November 2021. Our interview was with Anna Araújo about her book, No Compromise, the work of Florence Knoll. This has been a presentation of the Ann Arbor District Library.